me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The plaintiffs invited the Supreme Court to not only strike down ICWA, but to gut the legal foundation of tribal sovereignty. And yesterday, in a stunning defeat for the plaintiffs, the Supreme Court said no.
In a surprise decision, the Supreme Court votes to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act in a major victory for tribal sovereignty. We'll get the latest, then go to Montana, where calls are growing for authorities to investigate the death of Micah Westwolf, a 22-year-old Indigenous woman who died after being hit by a car driven by a suspected white nationalist whose children are named Aryan and Nation. Then we talk to Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. He's calling on the Biden administration to declassify its report on the death of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akla, who was shot dead by an Israeli soldier.
This is an American citizen. We have a duty to pursue the facts wherever they lead, as Secretary Blinken himself said.
And we look at the black maternal health crisis following the tragic death of Olympic track and field star Tori Bowie, who died last month home alone after going into labor.
It highlights the problem where black mothers are, you know, not receiving the appropriate care and succumbing to issues that really are treatable and normally wouldn't have such awful outcomes.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Greek authorities have arrested 9 Egyptian nationals and charged them with people smuggling after their overloaded fishing vessel capsized and sank in deep waters off the coast of southern Greece Wednesday. Over 100 people were rescued, but hope is fading for an estimated 500 others who remain missing. That includes as many as 100 children who witnesses say were traveling below deck. It's the deadliest shipwreck off the Greek coast this year, possibly among the deadliest ever in the central Mediterranean. Protests in support of the migrants have erupted across Greece amid reports that a Greek Coast Guard vessel escorted the trawler for hours and failed to properly render aid as the vessel capsized. On Thursday, Greek opposition leader Alexis Tsipras visited with survivors at the port of Kalamata, where he condemned the European Union's policies on refugees and migrants.
I want to say there are huge political responsibilities with the migration policy that Europe has been following for years, a migration policy that turns the Mediterranean, our seas, into watery graves. And I think it is time to speak the truth, because this policy has to change.
Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott has taken credit for sending dozens of migrants to Los Angeles in a move condemned by Democrats as cruel and inhumane. It's the latest in a series of similar moves by Republican governors in recent months. On Wednesday afternoon, a busload of 42 migrants, including 8 children, arrived in Los Angeles after a 23-hour ride from McAllen, Texas, without food, they said. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass blasted Abbott, writing in a statement, quote, "It's abhorrent that an American elected official is using human beings as pawns in his cheap political game," she said. Los Angeles City Council member Aunices Hernandez also condemned Governor Abbott.
He's obviously a person who's been elected that is not strong enough to meet the moment in his state. But that's okay, because all these people here in Los Angeles and in California are more than capable of welcoming these folks here, because Los Angeles is a place and a city for everyone. And we'll keep pushing for our sanctuary policies to make sure that immigrants and migrants know that they are safe here, that they are welcome here. 1.3 million immigrants make up the city of Los Angeles. They are the nervous system, the heart of this city, and we have their back.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill Thursday barring transgender college athletes in Texas from competing on sports teams that align with their gender identities. This follows other anti-LGBTQ legislation recently passed in Texas, including a ban on gender-affirming care for transgender minors. In Ohio, Republican lawmakers have merged two anti-LGBTQIA bills into a single piece of legislation. The Ohio House is set to vote next week on the combined bill, which would ban puberty blockers or hormones for everyone under 18, bar transgender women and girls from female-only sports teams in Ohio, schools and colleges, and forbid Medicaid from paying for gender-affirming care for youth. It would also limit discussions of gender identity and sexual orientation in classrooms. The ACLU reports it's tracking 491 anti-LGBTQ bills in the U.S. during this year's legislative session. The Supreme Court has upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act in a ruling that protects Native children from being removed from their tribal communities for adoption or foster care in non-Native homes. In a stunning 7-2 ruling, Justice Amy Coney Barrett rejected an argument from Republican-led states and white families who argued the system is based on race, writing, quote, "In sum, Congress's power to legislate with respect to Indians is well established and broad." Indigenous leaders are celebrating Thursday's ruling, saying the 1978 law helps to preserve their families' traditions and cultures. After headlines, we'll speak with Rebecca Nagel, Cherokee writer, award-winning journalist, and host of This Land podcast. In Texas, at least three people were killed Thursday as a tornado tore through a trailer park in Panhandle City of Perryton. More than 75 people were injured. About 200 homes were destroyed. There's triple-digit heat in the forecast for the region this weekend, with temperature records set to fall in Houston and New Orleans, and 10 million people under excessive heat warnings through Saturday night. Authorities on Mexico's Pacific coast say hundreds of wild birds that have washed up along the shore died as a result of abnormally warm ocean waters resulting from the climate crisis and the warming trend known as El Nino. Mexico's health ministry reports at least six people have died this year from heat-related illnesses, with more extreme temperatures forecast for this weekend. On Thursday, the European Union's climate agency said global surface air temperatures briefly rose by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels earlier this month for the first time ever. That's the maximum global temperature rise agreed to under the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Here in New York, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Thursday countries must immediately phase out the burning of coal, oil and gas, calling them incompatible with human survival. Guterres also accused fossil fuel companies of attempting to kneecap progress on the climate crisis.
Current policies are taking the world to a 2.8 degree temperature rise by the end of the century. That spells catastrophe, yet the collective response remains pitiful. We are hurtling towards disaster, eyes wide open, with far too many willing it all on wishful thinking and proven technologies and silver bullet solutions. It's time to wake up and step up.
As Secretary of State Tony Blinken makes his way to China to discuss the war in Ukraine, U.S.-China relations and other issues, Russia has fired a fresh volley of missiles on Ukraine's capital. Earlier today, explosions rang out across Kyiv, where Ukraine's military claims it shot down six hypersonic missiles, six cruise missiles and two reconnaissance drones. The daytime attacks came as seven African heads of state, led by South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, visited Kyiv in a bid to kickstart peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. Meanwhile, top Pentagon officials called Thursday for U.S. allies to continue pouring weapons into Ukraine. Speaking from a meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group in Belgium, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin asked allies to, quote, dig deep to provide Ukraine with air defense systems and more ammunition. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Mark Milley acknowledged Ukraine's military is suffering heavy losses as it presses a counteroffensive against entrenched forces in eastern Ukraine.
There are several hundred thousand Russian troops dug in prepared positions all along the front line. Ukraine has begun their attack, and they are making steady progress. This is a very difficult fight. It is a very violent fight, and it will likely take a considerable amount of time and at high cost.
A federal grand jury has indicted 21-year-old Air National Guard member Jack Teixeira on 6 counts of willful retention and transmission of classified information over the recent leak of highly classified Pentagon intelligence documents. Teixeira has been jailed since April. If convicted, he faces up to 10 years in prison for each charge. Teixeira is accused of violating the same part of the Espionage Act used by federal prosecutors to charge Donald Trump over his mishandling of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. Trump was released without having to pay bond after pleading not guilty at his arraignment in a Miami federal court on Tuesday. Back in the United States, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union has reached a tentative agreement on a 6-year labor contract covering some 22,000 dock workers at all 29 ports along the West Coast. The deal, which is subject to ratification by members, caps more than a year of negotiations after the union's previous contract expired last July. And Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo has signed legislation allocating $380 million in public funds for a new Major League Baseball ballpark in Las Vegas. The bill clears the way for the Athletics to apply to the MLB to relocate from Oakland, California, where the team has played for over half a century. Oakland A's executives hired more than a dozen lobbyists to press lawmakers in Nevada's capital, Carson City, to approve a $1.5 billion stadium, arguing it'll create jobs and boost Las Vegas's economy. Writing about the move in The Nation magazine, sports editor Dave Zirin commented, quote, "This is about billionaire sports owners demanding socialism for the rich and seasonal service industry work for the laboring class. They are urban hostage takers demanding a king's ransom from the public trough," Zirin wrote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with a major victory at the Supreme Court in a case that could have gutted Native American sovereignty. On Thursday, the court upheld the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act that protects Native children from being removed from their tribal communities for fostering or adoption in non-Native homes. Tribal leaders say the law helps to preserve their families, traditions, and cultures. In a stunning 7-2 ruling, Justice Amy Coney Barrett rejected an argument from Republican-led states and white families who argued the system is based on race, writing, quote, "In sum, Congress's power to legislate with respect to Indians is well established and broad." Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote in a concurring opinion, quote, "The Indian Child Welfare Act did not emerge from a vacuum. It came as a direct response to the mass removal of Indian children from their families during the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s by state officials and private parties," unquote. Many are also taking note of the final paragraph of Justice Gorsuch's opinion. It reads, quote, "Often, Native American tribes have come to this court seeking justice only to leave with bowed heads and empty hands. But that is not because this court has no justice to offer them. Our Constitution reserves for the tribes a place, an enduring place, in the structure of American life. It promises them sovereignty for as long as they wish to keep it. And it secures that promise by divesting states of authority over Indian affairs and by giving the federal government certain significant but limited and enumerated powers aimed at building a lasting peace. In adopting the Indian Child Welfare Act, Congress exercised that lawful authority to secure the right of Indian parents to raise their families as they please, the right of Indian children to grow in their culture, and the right of Indian communities to resist fading into the twilight of history." Gorsuch concluded, "All of that is in keeping with the Constitution's original design," unquote. Meanwhile, Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas both wrote dissents, with Thomas objecting to, quote, "regulating state court child custody proceedings of U.S. citizens who may never have even set foot on Indian lands merely because the child involved happens to be an Indian," unquote. For more on all of this, we're joined in Oklahoma by Rebecca Nagel, a Cherokee writer, award-winning journalist who followed this case closely in a piece for The Nation headlined, "The Story of Baby O and the Case That Could Gut Native Sovereignty." She's also the host of This Land podcast. In season 2, she's been reporting on how the far right is using Native children to attack American Indian tribes and advance a conservative agenda. Rebecca, welcome back to Democracy Now! Please, first, first respond to this, what shocked many Native American tribes and communities, and also tell us the story of Baby O.
Mm. Thank you, Amy, so much for having me and for covering this important issue. Really, what happened with this case is that for the past decade, special interest groups have used this law, the Indian Child Welfare Act, as a vehicle to launch a broader attack on tribes and tribal sovereignty. And so the arguments that they invited the Supreme Court to adopt would have not only gotten rid of the Indian Child Welfare Act, but it would have really destabilized the area of law a lot of people call federal Indian law. And instead of taking that invitation, the Supreme Court responded with a very, very strong no. One of the ways that these special interest groups have advanced these cases is by really misrepresenting the facts on the ground and what happened when these non-Native foster parents tried to adopt Native children. So it's a complicated case. There's multiple foster parents. One of those couples is a couple named the Librettis from Nevada. When a child was placed with them through Safe Haven, within a few weeks, her father was identified. It was identified that her father was a descendant of a federally recognized tribe and that she was eligible for enrollment. And the process started for her to be placed with a family member. And the Librettis' response to that was extraordinary. I mean, they wrote a letter to that child's grandmother asking her to disenroll so that ICWA would not imply. They managed to rope social workers into their plot who either refused to call relatives who were possible placements or when they made those calls, tried to talk the relatives out. And basically, Nevada social workers strong-armed the tribe into entering a settlement. And so, and we found, you know, stories like that in all of the underlying custody cases. And so what really happened in this case was rather than non-Native foster parents being able to adopt, being prevented from adopting Native kids, for the most part, they won custody. And the people who faced the real hurdles were the Native relatives who just wanted to keep their young relatives in their family.
And so what ultimately happened to Baby O, and how did this case make it to the Supreme Court?
So Baby O, like many of the other children in the underlying custody cases, all of the children in the underlying custody cases have been adopted, and those adoptions are final. And so Baby O was adopted by the Librettis, and that's who she's being raised by, despite there being several blood relatives that came forward during her case who wanted to raise her. And that was one of the things that I was relieved to see in the Supreme Court case. You know, this case has been on stilts since it was filed in federal court. All of the underlying adoptions have been long final. And normally, when that happens, a lawsuit is over. You know, there needs to be a controversy for a lawsuit to move forward. And I think one of the things that the Supreme Court signaled in this ruling is that it is more dedicated to the rule of the law and the rule of civil procedure than the politics of this case. Because one of the things that the plaintiffs invited the Supreme Court to do was to ignore those things and instead to make a political decision. And they rejected that, which I think is good, not just for Native nations and families, but for the rule of law.
So, Rebecca Nagel, can you talk about the comments of Justice Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett? These are some of the most conservative members of the court. And the fact that this shocked Native Americans around the country. And to also talk about why would organizations like gambling casinos be very invested in this case? When you talk about, by the way, ICWA, that's the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Yeah, so the special interest groups that have been attacking ICWA for the past decade kind of fall into three buckets. So it's a handful of private adoption attorneys. And if you look at the private adoption industry, they've fought basically any regulation that would result in there being less children who are available for adoption. There are some right-wing organizations like the Goldwater Institute. We also found a lot of money flowing into the anti-ICWA campaign from the Bradley Foundation. And then who's really spearheading the effort now is a law firm called Gibson Dunn and a lawyer there named Matthew McGill. And last January, the other shoe dropped. And so they actually, Gibson Dunn Dunn and Matthew McGill filed a lawsuit on behalf of a casino developer saying that tribal gaming was racial discrimination against him because he could not make as much money as the tribes. And so they've basically used the exact same arguments that they're making to attack ICWA to attack tribal gaming. And so I think the hope for them was that if they won this case, they could sort of have the follow-up case to attack tribal gaming. And fortunately, they were unsuccessful. A lot of people are surprised by Gorsuch and Barrett. I'm not. I think that if you listen to oral arguments, Barrett was really positioning herself in the middle on this case. And so when I saw that the opinion was authored by Barrett, I had a sigh of relief with that news. And then as I continue reading, I was even more relieved. We've had a lot of liberal justices that have sat on the bench that have not been friendly to tribal sovereignty because I think that they don't understand it. I think Justice Ginsburg is somebody that people point to a lot. I think it is good for tribes to have justices that really understand the law and how that law relates to the Constitution. I think what Gorsuch did in his concurring opinion that we almost never see was that he talked about the long history of the U.S. government removing Native children from their families. And the reason that that is important is that he's talking about why ICWA is important from the perspective of Native people. And I think that often our perspectives and our stories and our histories aren't told at venues like the Supreme Court. So to see that coming from a justice was really powerful.
And so where does this case go from here in terms of Native American law, U.S. law?
Yeah, so, in the past decade, ICWA has been challenged almost as many times as the Affordable Care Act. This case is the closest and the furthest they have ever gotten in their effort to overturn ICWA. And they got a very, very strong rejection from the Supreme Court. And so I think time will tell whether or not they will bring other cases. Our reporting found other cases that are still sort of in family court that these corporate lawyers are swooping in to represent non-Native families. So they'll continue to do that. What's next for the Supreme Court is yet to be seen. The past few years, we've had some great decisions. We've had some bad decisions. It's been a bit of a roller coaster. But I think what's important about this case is that we're seeing not only the Supreme Court, but I think the public show more of an interest and more of a knowledge about the Constitution and tribal sovereignty and how all these things work. I think some of our biggest barriers at the Supreme Court has been ignorance. And I think seeing that knowledge come out in the Supreme Court opinion is really encouraging.
Rebecca Nagle, we want to thank you for being with us, Cherokee writer and award-winning journalist. We'll link to your piece in The Nation, headlined The Story of Baby O and the Case That Could Gut Native Sovereignty. She's also the host of This Land podcast. Coming up, we're going to Montana, where calls are growing for authorities to investigate the death of Micah Westwolf, a 22-year-old indigenous woman who died after being hit by a car driven by a suspected white nationalist. Her two children's names are Aryan and Nation. But first, we'll talk to Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. He's calling on the Biden administration to declassify its report on the death of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, shot dead by an Israeli soldier. Stay with us. Call police. Bye. If I don't see you in the future, I'll see you in the pasture. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's continuing to face criticism for its response to the killing last year of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier as she was reporting on an Israeli military raid just outside the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Al Jazeera reporter was shot while wearing a blue helmet and blue flak jacket, clearly emblazoned with the word press. Shireen Abu Akleh was one of the most prominent TV journalists in the Arab world. She was also a U.S. citizen. NBC News recently reported the FBI has not yet spoken to any key witnesses in the case. Israel's refused to cooperate with the probe, and Palestinian journalists who were with Shireen at the time of her death say the FBI has never contacted them. Many of the journalists who witnessed her death spoke to Al Jazeera correspondent Sharif Abdelkadous for the documentary The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, which just won a George Polk Award. This is Shireen's producer, Ali Al-Samoudi, who was also shot that day.
When we made sure that there were no confrontations, we started walking slowly, with slow steps.
And about 25 seconds later, here they are walking with Shada and Mujahid up the street, all in their press jackets, just past the spot where Salim had a view of the military.
Suddenly, a round of bullets was fired. I shouted, "Shireen, they're shooting at us. We have to get out of here." Just as I was saying, "We have to get out of here," my shoulder exploded. I shouted, "Shireen, I was shot," or I said, "Shireen, they shot me."
After the first bullet, I was able to jump behind a short wall to take shelter. Shireen and Shatha reached me to jump and get out of the place, but they couldn't.
They started firing at us. I immediately pressed record. I saw Ali was wounded. He walked away. Shireen was behind the tree. I could still see her hiding behind the tree.
The last words that Shireen said was, "Ali has been wounded. Ali has been wounded." I mean, these ears, every day, all the time, Shireen's voice is repeating in my ears.
I stepped forward again and they started saying, "Shireen, Shireen," but they shot at us again.
I have a blank spot in my mind. I don't remember how I got behind the tree. I got behind the tree and turned around to see if Shireen could come to where I was. At that point, I saw Shireen falling to the ground. I didn't understand that she had been gravely wounded.
I stepped forward and saw Shireen on the ground. I'm holding the camera. I bend down. I want to walk. To walk toward Shireen.
The whole time I wanted to shake her, to touch her, to move her. But I was also filled with fear because the tree was what was protecting us. And if I moved her, maybe she would be wounded again. I remember when I saw the blood on the ground. When the blood started coming out, that's when I realized that she had taken a bullet to the head. And I started shouting, "It's her head, her head."
An excerpt from The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh from Al Jazeera English's current affairs program, Fault Lines. The documentary recently won a George Polk Award for Foreign Television Reporting, one of the highest awards in journalism. Investigations by Al Jazeera, The New York Times, CNN, and other news outlets have challenged the official Israeli version of Shireen's killing. We're joined now by Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, who's called on the U.S. State Department to declassify a report on Shireen Abu Akleh's death on May 11, 2022, conducted by the U.S. Security Coordinator for Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Senator Chris Van Hollen joins us now from Kensington, Maryland.